All right, it's Fan Peak pregame on a Friday. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff.
Yes, Ailish, sir.
Enjoying a long weekend. Toronto Blue Jays provided some late drama there, but fallen extras to the Chicago Cubs' first appearance at Wrigley 7 years, which seems impossible.
That
but
does seem impossible.
We've had some wacky times. We'll have Buck Martinez in a moment. Dan's back in the booth tomorrow. Very exciting. We'll switch gears at 6:30, bring Sportsnet's Anna Dua on to tee up the King's Plate and chat a little NHL. That will come after, though. Phil Wizard, first ever Olympic B-boy champion. So we have a gold medal performance from Paris to start the second block and a gold medal performance to open block one. Jesse Rubinoff, freshly back from Paris.
Yeah.
How was it?
Well, it's a gold medal city. I got to say that. Food's incredible. Yeah, the thing I don't understand is that they eat well there. Like a lot of croissants.
Yeah.
A lot of baguettes. A lot of onion soups. Everyone's fit. Like everyone. I guess it's because they walk around in Europe a lot more than we do here, but like just a beautiful looking population.
Yeah.
Like everybody's fit somehow. It just didn't really make any sense to be being there. But an amazing place to walk around. Obviously being there for the Olympics was really, really cool. The first time I asked for a French onion soup, the waiter kind of looked at me a little bit weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what it is at
Drop
all.
The French.
It's just a straight onion soup.
That would make sense.
So yeah. I had a lot of those. But just an amazing time. 3 weeks is a long time to be in one place, but lucky enough that it was a world-class city like Paris. So I had a blast, but happy to be back.
So you're working, grinding away.
Working,
so it
yes.
wasn't like just, hey, I'm going to every single Olympic event. But did you manage to see any Olympic events?
So here's the interesting story. So yeah, I was working out of the International Broadcasting Center. And every time I come back from vacation, I have to get my dog a toy. So
he or she demands that?
She demands it. Yeah, okay. She goes through the luggage. She'll just be depressed if she doesn't find a toy.
Okay.
So I woke up one morning, and this is near the end of the trip, and I went all the way downtown, and I was staying near the airport. So like a pretty big trek to go get your dog a toy, which is like just an insane thing to do.
I got out of the subway. That.
Well, I got out of the subway, and I hadn't really seen any events to that point because I was working at night, and it's expensive to get to certain events. I got out of the subway, and I couldn't cross the street to get to the pet store because the men's marathon was happening. And it was awesome to watch. Like my day just like it got blown up. Like I literally was walking for miles trying to figure out a way to cross the street. Couldn't do it. And obviously the security all over the place. Like, sir,
you would have had to run. If you ran the route, you probably could have got to the pet store.
Yeah, it's like, sir, you cannot cross here.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I got it. But I ended up just like walking along the route of the marathon and watching these athletes. And the thing that I took away from it mostly was that the crowd was unbelievable. Mm. Like, and that's something that you also saw through the TV, but actually being there in person, like the noise was out of control. You're thinking like it's a marathon. Like, yeah, you know, they cheer the runners on. Like,
yeah,
that's
you
cool.
See them all one time.
Yeah.
Unless you're running.
But it was like loud.
Yeah.
So this is very, the national pride was really there for everybody and flags all over the place. And just a really cool experience. Suffice to say, I ended up, still getting a toy, but it wasn't from that pet store because I literally couldn't find a way across the street.
Good thing it wasn't like the Harbor Front marathon where it takes some people like 5 hours to finish. Like at least all these Olympic athletes.
But yeah, it was a pivot went to the Eiffel Tower, also a beautiful place, clearly international landmark. So yeah, I mean, it was an amazing time, but I mean, what did I miss? I know Vladdy's now Babe Ruth.
I mean, you didn't miss all that much, but things definitely, as we were discussing things, have changed. But I do have one more question because, of course, the Olympics did start negatively for Canadians, and you're working where there's other people from other countries, like a big collaborative effort, just like the Olympic
you're
Games.
You're talking drones?
Yeah, the drones. Were you just made fun of? Were you like banished from the group because the Canadian was working alongside all the other people who were contributing on this project, but you had to be, connected to the stain of the Olympic Games, at least.
Yeah, there was a lot of pointing and laughing going on, for sure. Like, there was a lot of
that. It's actually
that.
Like a good introduction process
to,
like, working with new people.
Yeah.
You're the Canadian, and you're the cheater.
And it was a lot of British people working with who I was working with, and obviously very interested in football, soccer, and they all knew about the story. So it's not like I was going to work with people who, like, didn't follow that sport at all and didn't know the drone fiasco. They all knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And they let us know that they knew about it. I mean, can't do that. I know there's like a segment of the population who looked at the story and said, oh, and everyone kind of does it in some respect. But made for some weird conversations, but yeah, that's for sure.
I think if we learned anything, it's like, yeah, everyone's trying to get information. Everyone's, you know, I guess trying to cheat in the most respectful ways possible, but we were like the dumb ones, right? Like, yeah, we just didn't have the sophistication. We didn't have the smarts to be like, oh, there are drone laws in France. I hope you didn't bring a drone.
I did.
Assuming you didn't.
I didn't. No, I didn't have any drones on me. But yeah, you're right. Like, if you know, there's the saying, if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. But don't get caught. You get caught, you're in some trouble.
So Canadian on the ground, what was like the proudest moment of the Olympic Games as you were digesting all this as a Canadian in Paris?
Well, it is pretty cool to get to talk to Phil Wizard, because that, you know, in a new event like that, that's something to be proud of for Canada. I would say probably Summer. Like, she was just unbelievable the whole way through. And, you know, people knew about her. Like, there's stories that sort of resonate amongst individual countries. And then there's stories that kind of take over the Olympics. And I think Summer McIntosh was one of those stories that sort of permeates the building in which we're working. And everybody sort of perks up and knows who you're talking about when you bring up her name. So that was probably... I mean, but yeah, and it was a really good showing for Canada. So it's a lot to be proud of.
Yeah, it was. And obviously we get excited about all the medal winning performances. We get excited about a boxing bronze medal or a judo bronze. Like, we get excited about all the things that are happening, but that's a good point, because there are a few athletes only at the Olympics who do transcend all sort of, you know, the games, but are in the homes of everyone globally. And I think, you know, Léon Machin would probably be one, because he was the biggest star in France. And there would, you know, there'd be many others, but Summer McIntosh was definitely one of them. The most successful Olympian by far for Canada at the Games. But yeah, it's interesting the lens you see it through being there, and the lens that we saw it through here, because I think a lot of us were preoccupied on the team sports for a lot of it. Like, and we definitely, the women's soccer thing starts, and that kind of takes our attention
deflating.
Away.
Yeah.
It was deflating at the start, but then it was inspiring as they were coming back, and we have the Esposito moment from Gilles, and we have all these great things, and everyone's behind them, and everyone, I think, was proud of what they did with the 9 points, even though they didn't get through the quarterfinals. And then we kind of experienced the disappointment of the basketball team, but like, that's not going to resonate, you know, the basketball quarterfinal loss for someone who's not Canadian. But it was a big moment here. But yeah, you're right. Summer McIntosh was the story of the Games for Canada and among the great athletes that were there. But the Léon Marchand thing was just next level in Paris.
Yeah. Here's another thing an observation of my time there. Like, I was a bit concerned when I got there that, you know, Paris is Paris and people are there regardless if they're there for the Olympics, they're there to have a great time. It's an incredible tourist city. And I was a little bit concerned on, you know, whether they were going to be into the Olympics as much as somewhere else that, you know, they bring everybody from around the world into the city. But, you know, Paris is a tourist place. So there's a lot of people there you would think not really associated with the Olympics. And do the locals care? Are they all escaping to the south of France? Like, what is that? And Marchand, for sure, was a major talking point. And everywhere you go, people were talking about him. But then there was one night where it was the France-US men's basketball game. And I was kind of just walking around one of the districts by myself, just sort of getting a lay of the land. And everyone was cheering. Every restaurant was tuned to the game. And I did not expect to see that. Like, I'm going downtown. I don't know what the equivalent would be, kind of like a Yorkville area or a Little Italy area. Or like, yeah, not a big deal. But everyone was watching and everyone was cheering. And everyone was tuned in. It was like the moment for them in Paris. And that was a concern that I had, but everyone bought into the Olympics being in Paris. And I thought that was something that was really, really cool. Like, didn't matter. It doesn't matter that you're in a city. You're not mad that the Olympics are coming.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you.
There wasn't really
any of that. You kind of think about what it would look like if it were here. If it was in Canada, of course, Vancouver had an Olympics. And I don't know the answer to this question when it comes to Vancouver, because I wasn't there. But I think of how disruptive it might be if it was in Toronto. I think about the World Cup coming to Toronto. What's that going to look like? And I can't tell this by what we had in like simple shots of Arash Madani outside the Louvre.
Yeah.
But it looked like it wasn't disruptive at all. Like the Olympics seamlessly fit in to this major city. And it wasn't an issue at all. And I'm trying to figure out if that's right, A, and how
it is.
B.
It is right. And I think what happened was everyone who came in from the Olympics took the place of a tourist who otherwise would have been there. And that's not to say that there were, you know, no tourists in Paris. because there were. I was at the Louvre. There were tourists there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the people there were wearing Olympic uniforms.
Yeah.
So a lot of, I think, the Olympic influx of people ended up replacing the tourists that are normally there, and that, you know, the Olympics is done now, are probably returning to Paris. Because you know if the Olympics are going, it's probably not the best time as a tourist to go to Paris because it's going to be overwhelmed. And I think just because of the idea of having the Olympic, you know, people come in and everyone else sort of move out, whether that's locals or tourists, it made for a pretty smooth experience. And I also think if you want to host an event of that magnitude, you got to figure out the infrastructure. Like, that's one thing about Paris that was amazing. The subway system is ridiculous. Like, you can get anywhere pretty quickly, and the traffic is not that much of a concern. There were buses everywhere looping the areas where you needed to be and all the venues and all that. And to envision that in certain North American cities and, you know, for the World Cup when it's here in Toronto, it's like, eh.
Yeah.
we got to figure that out.
I mean, that's definitely a consideration. You know, the Copa, I think, had wrapped up before you left. But we understand the Copa drama. But it is interesting to see what L.A. will be like in 4 years, because they're talking about having a no-car or a no-vehicle Olympics and how they're going to do that. But, like, you're not going to have everyone in L.A. just leave. Get up and leave. Yeah. Like, that's not going to happen. It's a tourist attraction, but it's not like, hey, here's a million people daily that are just going into the downtown core and visiting museums. Like, that's not how Los Angeles runs. So it will be interesting to see what it looks like in 4 years. And I guess Paris, a perfect destination for an Olympic Games. Let's switch gears. Buck Martinez is our Sportsnet color analyst, play-by-play man over the last couple of weeks, and a trusted resource of mine while planning an upcoming trip to Japan. And he joins us now from Chicago. Buck, how's it going? Thanks for coming on.
It's going well. I'm sorry I'm a little late. We just got back from the ballpark, and obviously a lot of Blue Jay fans, a lot of traffic around Wrigley Field. But, yeah, I'm good to go. How are you guys doing?
Oh, we're doing good, and that's all good because, it's the Blue Jays' first appearance at Wrigley in 7 years, and Wrigley's special. I imagine, well, you had a different perch today because it wasn't on our network. But, like, Wrigley Field, being back at Wrigley Field, special for you, Buck?
Absolutely, yeah. I called the 2016 World Series between the Indians at the time and the Cubs, and that was pretty special. It was a lot of fun. And the atmosphere was great today. I tell you what, there were an awful lot of Blue Jay fans, and they're all around downtown on the Miracle Mile having a good time. And three day games makes it really nice because you can come here, see the ball games, and enjoy Chicago itself at nighttime. So it's a good trip.
Buck, big picture and post-trade deadline, I mean, we saw the Springer tying it up with two outs in the ninth inning, which was very cool. Is there a different energy? I know maybe the results haven't been there. They had their winning streak snap today. But is there a different energy with this team post-trade deadline that, you know, the expectations of trying to make a run towards a postseason spot are obviously not there anymore? Is there a freedom that you're allowed to play with as a baseball player that otherwise wouldn't have existed earlier in the season that you're seeing from this team now?
Well, I don't know if it's a freedom. I think, you know, major league players are pretty well relaxed all the time when they're playing. But what's happening is the energy of the young guys that are getting a chance to play. You know, the Blue Jays had the fourth oldest team at the start of the season. Now they have the 12th youngest. And, you know, there's so many of these players are 26 and under, including Vladdy Guerrero Jr. So, you know, there is a lot of energy. Now the challenge for the organization is to find out, can these guys turn into major league players that will be capable of competing in the East? And, you know, you can say, well, yeah, you know, Horowitz is having some good at-bats, and, you know, Wagner's doing a nice job and is his starting his career. But now you have to make hard decisions. Are these the guys that we can develop and that will turn into contending ball players like the Blue Jays are looking to get? So, yeah, it's a good time. And I would expect you're going to see this team play this type of baseball the rest of the season.
Buck, obviously in the last couple of years, there's been some trying days, weeks, and months for Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but he always maintains the smile, the upbeat attitude. He's always trying to have fun at the ballpark. So I feel like it's worth asking you, who's around Vladdy and the players on a daily basis, is there any change in Vladdy when things are going really well compared to when things aren't going so well, or is it always just the same guy out there?
He's always the same guy. He loves to play baseball. He hates to lose. and he has changed his whole game plan now. I think he understands how important he is to this team, what he has to do to be the leading example. And we've seen that dramatically over the last month and a half, 2 months. But, you know, he's doing everything you want him to do. He's hitting for average, hitting with power, getting on base, not chasing pitches. And he's setting the tone the way this team needs to play going forward. So, yeah, I know he's a free agent after next year, and I know there's a lot of discussion about should you sign him for the long haul. And I'm certainly on the side of signing Vladdy Guerrero Jr. for the long haul. I think he's the guy you build your organization around.
Is this the best he's ever looked to you? Because, you know, war-wise and some of the deeper numbers, the 2021 season was statistically better. But, you know, in the last month and a half or 2 months, there hasn't been a hotter hitter in all of baseball. So is this stretch to you the best that you've ever seen from Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? And what is it specifically that you've seen over that two-month stretch that has made you say, like, wow, this is amazing?
Yeah, I think the one thing about, you know, what he did a couple of years ago is a lot of that was in smaller ballparks. A lot of that was in minor league fields.
Right.
And now he's doing it in the big league fields, and, you know, he's got a 940 OPS. I mean, that's obviously the highest outside of that year in 2021. But, you know, I think he's reached the point. He's 25 years old. But, you know, he's been in the league since 2019, and he's got a four-time All-Stars already. He's been an All-Star four times, and I just think he understands what it takes to be an everyday big league player and an everyday big league star, and I think he can be that.
What are you seeing from Will Wagner, Buck? I mean, obviously the numbers are the numbers. The start is the start, but what impresses you about what he's been able to do in such a short time up here with the Toronto Blue Jays?
Well, I think he's been able to succeed because he's not overwhelmed by being in the big leagues. You know, he was around his dad all the time. When Billy Wagner left Houston in his ninth season, Will was five. So he started to understand what baseball was all about. So he's a very quiet young man, and he takes that personality to the plate with him. He's very quiet at the plate, doesn't try to do too much. But, I mean, we're seeing him have good at-bats. Only once or twice have we seen a real wild swing from him. But two more hits today, he's hitting .583, you know, in a very small number of games, of course. And it's not unlike what we saw with Davis Snyder last year when Davis came up and had that terrific run to start his career. So, you know, it's not a slam dunk. I mean, Will's not going to be like this the rest of his life. He's going to have ups and downs. But, you know, generally it takes hitters about 3 years before you really find out who you have for the long haul. And that's why I think Vladdy has reached that point now, where he's at that point where, you know, this is what you're going to get. But I like what I've seen from Wagner. I think he's a professional baseball player. I talked to Casey Candel, who managed him just for the brief time he was in Buffalo, and the first thing he said was, well, Wagner's a ball player. So, I mean, that's great endorsement from a guy who was really a ball player, Casey Candel. So, yeah, I like where he's at. I mean, obviously we have to kind of decide where he's going to play. He kicked the ball around a little bit today, and basically it was kind of a rough day for everybody defensively. The Cubs look like the Bad News Bears there in the middle of the game. But, yeah, it's interesting. And you know what? Joey Loperfido had a big hit today late in the game, and, you know, he's an interesting guy as well. So, and I think there's a couple more guys they acquired at the trade deadline that we will see before the end of the season that will give us all a little bit more encouragement.
What about some of the guys that have had more of a sample size who are younger earlier in the season, the guys like Spencer Horowitz and Ernie Clement coming up? Like, what have you seen from those guys and their ability to stick to it here at the major league level? Because, you know, there's an adjustment period, clearly, but it seems like the two of them have been able to really keep their head afloat at the major league level.
Yeah, and well, I'll start with Horowitz first. I mean, he's played 58 games. He's got 200 at-bats. And he's hitting .265, which is pretty good. And he's getting on base, and you know, but his OPS is still under 800. You know, he'd like to see a little bit higher, but I'll give him a pass because he's just getting started in his major league career. The question with him, like Wagner, is where's he going to play? Does he have enough range to be a pennant contending second baseman? And when you evaluate these players with the Blue Jays now, the first thing you have to think about is how do the Blue Jays match up position by position with the rest of the teams in the division. That's what's important. You've got to play in this division. The Yankees are the Yankees. The Red Sox never go anywhere too far. Baltimore's going to be good for a long time in Tampa Bay. I don't know how they do it, but they compete every single year. So you have to make up your mind and evaluate your team, your players, and be honest when you say, okay, we're good here. We're good at shortstop. We're good at second base. We're good at first base. We need to improve behind the plate. We need to improve in the bullpen. We need to add a couple more arms in the rotation. So those are all things that have to be addressed during this season and certainly in the off season.
Last one for you, Buck. It's, I guess, the season for Yariel Rodriguez, who got a no decision today, a bit of a fact-finding mission, figuring out what this player is going to be in the long term. So in your mind, how has he defined himself as a player moving forward for the Blue Jays? Where have you seen growth? Where have you seen potential pitfalls? And where do you think he's at in his indoctrination as a major leaguer?
I think he's intriguing. I like to use that word. He's intriguing because he's just now learning how to start. You know, early in the season, he began the season in spring training with some back issues. He made four starts in April and just 15 innings, and then he had more back problems. He was out until June. But I think we're seeing some real good things from him against Houston, 6 2/3, one run on two hits. The next outing at Seattle, six innings, one hit, no runs. There are a lot of good things that have happened during the course of his indoctrination into the major leagues, but I think he can be a starter. I think he can be an effective starter. I would say he'd ideally be a three or a four on this team, and I think he's going to be a big part of this team going forward.
Enjoy the next two afternoons, Buck. Always a treat being at Wrigley. I'm sure you guys are going to enjoy it, and we'll be watching. Thanks for jumping on this afternoon.
Great to be with you guys. Hey, have a great rest of your evening.
You as well. That's Buck Martinez, who will be on the call this weekend for Sportsnet as the Blue Jays visit Wrigley Field and the Chicago Cubs. You made a comment about my jeans earlier.
I did.
Yeah. You don't remember?
No.
You commented on my
jeans.
And you did so, I think, because, you know.
Oh, I did.
Good quality jeans.
How comfortable they looked.
And that's the thing. It's like, I will pay for quality when I know it's quality. And I think that's where we're at with Vladdy, right? We had this fact-finding mission for Vladdy as well. You kind of missed the best of Vladdy this year while you were in Paris. But, you know, clearly we have a really, really special talent who's rediscovered his form. Are you just all in, like it seems like everybody is, on the notion of keeping him around, making sure he's the centerpiece moving forward? Because at this time last summer, a lot of people were ready to move on, or at least go Bo Bichette route instead. And it's flipped, and maybe we're falling into the recency bias trap. But this year and this stretch has been very, very unanimous in terms of what it's meant to everybody watching.
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious that, you know, in the coming years or year or 2 years from now, he could go back to being, you know, what he was last year or the year before and not be playing at this level. You hope that he's figured something out. But at the end of the day, talents like this and the numbers that he's putting up right now, I mean, these players don't come around all that often. A guy who hits 320 and he's going to hit 35 home runs and 100 RB, like, that is not that easy to find. Like 260 with 30 home runs and 90 RBI, a little bit easier. But a guy in the middle of the order who just keeps the rally going as often as Vladimir Guerrero Jr. does, that's not easy to find. And being 25 years of age, it just feels like ownership was willing to spend a certain amount on Shohei Ohtani. So obviously, if the right player is there, they will spend. Is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Shohei Ohtani? Not quite, but he's a pretty darn good baseball player. So it feels like the coffers are going to have to be opened for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And I think the fact that Bo Bichette has struggled to the degree that he has makes it a lot easier to re-sign Vladimir Guerrero Jr. because he becomes the de facto face of the franchise moving forward.
It's interesting you bring up Shohei because it was kind of like, okay, this is what Shohei can do for the business, for the ball club, for everything. But now this is a conversation of what happens if you don't give it to Vladdy, because this is the current reality. It's always, at least in the last 7-8 years, has included Vladdy, or at least the future prospects of Vladdy. And now if you're asking the question or you're mulling this, it's like, what's on the flip side of that? And that's something that I guess Blue Jays management is going through right now, but it does feel like moving on from him would be pretty devastating.
Marco, like, what do you do?
Like, where you're headed and what your intentions are going to be. And we can say goodbye to 2025. Okay, up next, a busy block, an Olympic champion and Phil Wizard and Anna Dewitt to talk about the King's Plate and a little NHL. That's after the break.
In-depth Blue Jays coverage with an analytical twist. Jays Talk Plus with Blake Murphy. Be sure to subscribe and download Jays Talk on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back on the Fan pregame final block of the week. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff. Ailish back Monday. Okay, among B-boys, of which there are many, at least I'm told, only one can call themselves Olympic champion.
That's
our
so
next
sick
guest, Phil Wizard, who's on the line with us now. Phil, thanks for jumping on. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you guys?
We're doing pretty good. We don't live life as an Olympic gold medalist, though, so we got to ask you, how is life since becoming an Olympic champion?
I don't know. It's only been a week and I feel like I'm still coming down from it. I just got home yesterday. I spent right after the event a couple days in Paris with my buddies and just kind of cruised around. But you get noticed more, like you get recognized more, which I don't know if it's a good or bad thing. I like my quiet at home. So it's been, I mean, it's been cool, but it's been a little weird. I haven't fully processed everything yet.
How did you feel about the way the Olympics embraced breaking as a sport, obviously making its debut at the Olympics? How did you feel everything went from the perspective of breaking as an Olympic sport?
I think it went amazing. I can only talk about how the event, like being there at the event, the atmosphere was amazing. Music licensing is a huge thing in breaking, and that's been a difficulty in a lot of previous events and just our regular circuit events. But they were able to play a lot of classic break music, like breakbeat for us, which was amazing, hearing like Judgment Day and hip hop music where we're used to just kind of more, I guess, boring tracks. So it was super exciting. The energy in the room was amazing. There's a lot of camaraderie between a lot all the dancers just because we knew how difficult the process was to get there. So all in all, it was an amazing experience.
So a lot of Canadians, I would say upwards of 95 to 99% of Canadians, didn't know exactly what to expect from breaking. I wonder, did it meet your expectations? Like when you went out there, was that what you expected? Did the competition go as expected? Did the judging go as expected? Or is this kind of commonplace and it's just, you know, Olympic branding and the same old that we do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I think leading up to the event, like for me, I felt a lot of anxiety and pressure and expectation because we're, you know, this is the Olympics. It's something different. As of now, this is kind of a one-time chance for us. And again, it was a very long process coming into this, so there's a lot of pressure. But when I actually got to the event, I was like, oh, it felt very familiar to me. It was a similar stage to many that I've performed at. It was a crowd that I'm used to performing in front of thousands of people sometimes in a lot of different competitions. And everything felt very familiar, which was a very good thing for us. I felt very comfortable on that stage. I had a lot of friends in the audience and a lot of the community came out as this was a historic moment for us. And so it felt very comfortable to be up there.
How did your preparation change, if at all, for the Olympics versus, say, a World Championships? Did you just try and keep everything as similar to the way you've done it in the past for the Olympics? Or was there something, knowing that, you know, I have to peak at the right time because this is the Olympics, was it different at all for you?
Not really. For myself, my motto has always been stay ready so you don't have to get ready. Like I love training. That's kind of my biggest thing that I love to do. I will say I trained more than I would normally do. I put in the extra, like normally I would train like 2 times a day. And especially leading up to the Olympics, maybe 1 or 2 weeks before, I was training 3 times a day just to kind of push my body a little bit more. But in terms of other than that, it was pretty similar. I had a couple sparring buddies the week before. So I did a training camp the week before in Vichy, which is 3 hours outside of Paris, just to acclimate. So that's not something I would typically do. So there was definitely some changes. But regarding how I trained and stuff wasn't too different. I still trained, like I was still experimenting a lot, still running my movements, still getting ready as I normally would for a competition, still eating whatever I wanted. I was eating a lot of pastries, eating a lot of croissants, stuff like that. So not a ton really changed.
Oh, that's great. We're talking to Olympic champion Phil Wizard. It felt like we were waiting forever to see Phil Wizard because, you know, we heard about it early on in the process. And I guess, you know, you were going through your own training, but did it feel like as the Olympics were happening that you were waiting on your competition too?
Definitely. It's kind of a weird, because I was there early. I went for opening ceremonies, which was an incredible experience. And then when I was there, I was like, oh, we're actually here now. We've arrived. But then I still had like a long time before my actual event. I went to my training camp, came back the Sunday, and I wasn't competing until Saturday. So I felt like I was just waiting the whole time. And you're watching a lot of other sports. You're watching a lot of the other athletes compete. You're meeting athletes in the village. And then you're, and being the last event, it was great to close it all out, but at the same time, you're just like waiting to go. So it was kind of just like, okay, I want to get this done. I want to get it over with. There was a lot of anxiety, a lot of excitement, a lot of mixed emotions for sure.
When did you know you had it in the bag? When did you know you were going to win gold? Because an interesting part of the competition, again, I'm no expert here, but I feel like I saw it in your face that you knew at one point that you were going to win the gold. Did you feel that way during the competition?
It's funny because actually, like, I will say that event, I don't think was my best performance. I don't think that I was like on top of my game. I remember going into it, like the round robin, I was like, I don't feel like 100% today. I don't feel great. I was mentally a little bit like all over the place. But then I was still winning my round. So I was like, okay, just push through. I've done this before where I've won events where I might not have been physically or mentally at my best. But I think that's also the difference between oftentimes the winners and people who lose is even in the states where you're not at your best, you have to push through. When I got to top eight, I was versus Lee from the Netherlands, who for me is one of the best breakers in the world. He's a really good friend of mine as well. And I thought I was going to lose, to be completely honest. But then I won that event and then won that round. And then as I was moving forward, I was like, okay, let's just see how far I can get. I won the semifinals. When I got to the finals, I was kind of like, all right, win or lose, I get a medal. So let's just enjoy this. Let's have fun. It was really not until the last round of the finals where I felt like it felt like a bit of a victory lap for me. Mm. I felt pretty confident that I won the first two rounds. And then the last round, they played the Mexican, I believe the song is. And it was just such a good track. It was such a good moment. The energy was amazing. I was doing really well in that round, and it really felt like I felt like I secured it in that last round.
So when you knew that you won, like what is that feeling like? Like what does it feel like to win a gold medal at the Olympics? Because obviously the two of us sitting here, we have no idea what that feels like. So if you could help us and the viewers, what did it feel like to win a gold medal at the Olympics?
I think I'm still processing. Like I still don't really believe it. It was an incredible feeling just knowing that I had so much love and support there. Like I had my friends and my family and so many people that typically don't come out to watch me. Mm. It was my entire like immediate family was there. It was my dad's first time ever seeing me compete, as well as my brothers. My mom had seen me one other time, but like seeing them out in the audience and being able to look at them while I'm competing, that meant so much to me. But it's such a whirlwind because like right after you win, you go to media right away and then you go do the ceremony. And then right after you have to do like the doping test. And then I had to do like 3 hours of media right after. And then like we went out after too. So like, honestly, the day just like, it went by so fast that like by the end of the day, I woke up and I was like, I don't really know what's going on. Like, I guess I won. But like, again, I feel like I'm still processing.
How rare is breaking beef? Because you mentioned your friends with the guy you beat in the quarterfinal. It looks like there is a bond between all the competitors that is like pretty significant. Like a lot of sports are like that, where there's mutual respect, of course. And sometimes there are rivalries, of course. But it felt like a sport where everyone was kind of, it was a competition, but it was also a celebration. Is that what the role or the vibe is all the time with breaking, where everyone's competing, but this is almost half or 50% a show, where it's for everyone, it's a competition, but it's also a performance that you two are putting on together?
Yes and no. I think it depends on the event. I think this one was the most, I will say, that it was kind of like that. Mm. I think, again, there was a lot of camaraderie just knowing how difficult the process was to qualify and to get here. And all of us just wanted to showcase as like the ambassadors for the sport, showcasing for the first time at the Olympic Games. I think there was a mutual understanding of just like, we want to put on a good show and we want to show how positive and how amazing this sport is. A lot of the guys I competed against, I compete with. So in the format for the Olympics, it was a one-on-one, but we do a lot of competitions where it's 2-on-2, 3-on-3, a crew battle. And so the guys I'm competing against are people that I've competed with, like are some of my closest friends. Again, Lee is another, is a good example that I battled in top eight. Like we have a group chat together and we're talking every day all the time, you know? And so a lot of us, we're really good friends. We travel the world together as well. And so you see that camaraderie in a lot of different events, but I think this one particularly, just knowing how difficult the process was, everyone was kind kind of in it together.
Obviously, when you're there, you have a job to do, and you definitely succeeded in your job in winning a gold medal. But being a part of Team Canada while you're there, what was that like for you? Because there's so much other, you know, so many other sports going on, so many other disciplines. Did you get to take any time to watch some of those events? Did you connect with any of the other athletes on Team Canada? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, for us, like coming into the sport world is so new. And honestly, it's been such an incredible experience, not just over the Olympics, but in the last year, I've been fortunate enough to meet a lot of different athletes in different shoots and different projects and stuff. And it was an amazing experience, like just being in the village. There's obviously that Team Canada camaraderie. And like I was watching, I didn't get to see any live. I couldn't get tickets to any of the events that I really wanted to go to. But if I didn't see it live, I was watching on the phone. And I don't really watch a lot of sports, to be honest. But it was the one time that I was like cheering loud and like cheering on my friends. When you're that emotionally invested, when you know the person, it's like so much more intense and so much more interesting. And so, again, I have a lot of friends that I've made over the last year that are part of Team Canada. And it was so cool to be able to cheer them on and just to have that experience together. It was truly like it's going to be an unforgettable kind of core memory for me.
So in 4 years, we will not see breaking in LA, but the future of breaking at the Olympics, I guess, still to be determined, maybe on a every 4 years basis. Do you dream? And I know it's early, you're still digesting, but do you dream of defending your Olympic title?
I don't know. Like you said, we're not in the next one. So, I mean, I hope we come back. I remember kind of reflecting on it and just being like, this was such an incredible experience. And it was so cool to be a part of this world that's so different from ours. But at the same, and I think a lot of people really enjoyed breaking, at least the people that were there watching it. I know they enjoyed it. The energy was incredible. And so we would love to come back. I think it's pretty agreed upon in the community as well that this was such a net positive for us. If it were to happen again, like say in 8 years, I would love to do it again if the kids aren't that good. Like I feel like in 8 years, the kids were going to be so good that I don't think I can be able to compete because I'll be like 34, 35. But if I'm still competing at that level, I would love to do it. It'd be cool to be like maybe a last event for me if it were to happen in 8 years. But let's see.
Listen, I got bad news for you. I think you probably inspired the next generation of breakers in Canada. Doubt. And it might be tough to hold on to that title, but I wouldn't put it past Phil Wizard. Last one for you, Phil. What's next for you? Other than being recognized everywhere you go, what are the plans for the rest of the summer, the year? What's on the docket for Phil Wizard?
Yeah, honestly, the last week I've just been doing absolutely nothing, which has felt incredible just because it's been like a very busy and long year. And I love training. It's what I love to do. So being a slob for a week was fantastic. I loved it. For the rest of the year, it's busy. I'm in Toronto right now, but then tomorrow or 2 days from now, we have the King's Plate tomorrow, which I'm performing at, which I'm super excited for. But then the next day I leave to Vienna and I have a competition the week after that. And then I think I go to Taiwan after that for another competition, and with breaking, our season doesn't really end. Like I'll compete until about November, have a break for December, and then compete again in January. So it'll just be kind of go, same as usual.
All right, we're looking forward to tracking it. I might see you at the King's Plate tomorrow. Yeah. That'll be exciting for me. And yeah, soak it all in because an Olympic champion is forever. That's awesome, Phil. And we appreciated the performance and definitely the entertainment. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate that.
That's Phil Wizard, Olympic champion, joining us on the Fan pregame.
So cool.
Pretty cool. Like a perfect moment in time for him, right? Like you talked about being 34, 35, who came back in 8 years. If this is a one-off or a one-off, at least in his lifetime, is this the peak Phil Wizard right now? Is that the reason why he was able to be Olympic champion? Like it's unbelievable how life can work sometimes for people. And if this is truly a once in a lifetime opportunity that came at the perfect time in someone's life, that's pretty amazing for him.
34, 35 and breaking. Can you imagine?
I feel like it'll be a little more difficult. Like what's the age curve on breaking?
Oh my goodness. I mean, just watching that event. I mean, some of the stuff that they're able to do is just preposterous. I mean, it's like difficult to judge because everything you watch, they get into this flow and this rhythm. You're like, wow, that's pretty cool. But man, I think all said and done, a pretty good showing for breaking. And obviously for Phil, just an amazing moment for him. And you know, the thing that I think I understood a lot more being at the Olympics too, it's that all of these different sports, like they have circuits where they have the world championships and they have other competitions. So like as Phil said, like, yeah, the Olympics is obviously a monumental thing for him, but he has other competitions all over the world basically at all times. So, yeah, a good showing for breaking. And again, congratulations to Phil Wizard because he put on quite a show at Paris.
So cool that he knew he had a victory lap. Right?
Yeah.
Like what other instance in sports, I mean, victory lap, I guess, stems from having a victory lap in a sports environment. But
that
like that
so
just
cool.
doesn't happen, right?
Yeah.
That he knew he had it and he was able to just have fun with the last moment of his, you know, athletic performance on the Olympic stage. It's very, very cool. And yeah, he definitely did Canada proud. Anna Dua has been covering big ticket items for Sportsnet over the summer months. National Bank opened last week. You can catch her rocking a Fascinator, I believe, tomorrow at the King's Plate where Phil Wizard will be. And she joins us now. It could be just a me problem, Anna, but I feel like it would be stressful preparing for a broadcast that also doubles as a fashion show. Or are you a little stressed out about, you know, the responsibilities tomorrow?
Oh, I was really stressed out, especially because I wasn't quite aware of what extent the fashion went to at such events. My Fascinator was covered.
Anna, we got to reconnect just because I think the audio was a little light. I had trouble hearing. I'm assuming that our audience did as well. Yeah, not as difficult as a problem or not as difficult as a an objective to get ready as a fellow wearing a suit at the King's Plate. But if you're like, you got to have the Fascinator, you got to have the full meal deal at the King's Plate.
What
it is like the fashion moment of summer in Toronto.
I honestly don't know what I would do if I had to dress up. Like, I guess.
You just wear
I'm
a suit.
I'm not going to buy something because you're wearing that.
No, you
once.
Just wear a suit.
No.
Yeah.
You can't just wear a suit.
Yes.
It's so boring.
What else would you wear?
It's got to be like
a feathery hat.
It's got to be like pinstripes or something like extravagant. You can't just go there in like a regular suit. It's got to look like you're going to a 1920s
speakeasy. It's like wedding formal.
Yeah. No. Yeah, but yeah, it's, you know what? Horse racing? Underrated. Underrated. Woodbine's a good time, dude.
I had never been to a King's Plate, Queen's Plate, whatever it was, or whatever it was when I went. Like blown away by how much fun it was. Like everybody there is in a great mood. Like there's like what I guess a sporting event. Like, you know, there's some grumbling. Like people have done it a bunch of times. This is truly like a one off, right? So it's a one off event. Everybody's been looking forward to, and it is completely different. So everyone buys into the vibe and goes like the full meal deal on it. And when everyone's bought into something, it results in like a pretty good time. And you get to gamble on horse racing, which is very, very
Cool. Kentucky Derby is making its way up my bucket list of places to see. There's no doubt.
I think we have Anna back on.
Yeah.
Headphone problem resolved. We got you, Anna.
I got new headphones, actually. It's a laptop problem. That's the issue. But the headphones are locked and loaded. So
there we go. Okay, perfect. So we got the fashion show stress. And this is like maybe Sunday scaries, but also the stress of learning horses, ponies. Mm. Like, has this been like one of the most labor intensive assignments that you've received in your young career?
It absolutely has. I'm not going to lie to you. I was a little bit nervous when this came on my plate, especially because it's such a big event. But some really cool people are joining the broadcast with me tomorrow, including Eddie Olchek, who is part of the hockey world alongside me, and he loves horse racing. So I called him up. I got horse racing 101 from Edzo. So that was really helpful, and he's going to be on the broadcast with me tomorrow. So I use my resources to prepare.
What are you looking forward to the most over the course of the event or the weekend?
Definitely my outfit. I know I worked really hard on it. Okay, so like just putting it all out there. It's going to be good tomorrow, guys. And my Fascinator, I'm excited. But other than that, it's such a special event. You know, so many people come out. Horse races are just fun to be at. I've been to some as spectators. Hosting it is a completely different ball game, but it's just such a fun summer activity to be out there. I know tomorrow the weather's not looking the best. I hope the sun does come out, please, please. I'm praying right now, but it's just such a fun vibe. I've been at Woodbine like all summer and it's a blast every time I'm there.
Okay, so horse racing. National Bank Open, NHL, your wheelhouse, though. And we got to get some NHL because we haven't talked much about the NHL lately. And we're about a month away from training camp starting. If you were to pick one storyline, the main storyline heading into this NHL season, where would you peg that?
Oh, finally. This is a question I can't answer. I was worried about you guys asking me stuff about the horses. I think there are a lot of major moves this offseason in the NHL, and a lot of teams are going to look really different. I think the Nashville Predators are a big storyline from this offseason, obviously adding some big name items in Steven Stamkos, Jonathan Marchessault. And that's a team that was really neglected last season. Looking around at my fellow analysts, I'll admit I didn't think they were going to make the playoffs. A lot of people didn't think they were going to make the playoffs. And that's a team that consistently surprises. So I wonder, not that many people are talking about them even this offseason after all of that went down, how they're going to head into the season and if they're going to be a serious threat early on and at least a competitive team to play against. I think Utah is also flying under the radar with Mikhail Sergachev. That was a big one. I was not expecting that to happen over there in Utah. And sometimes people take these teams a little bit too lightly when they're new to the league. I remember it happening with Vegas, and we all see what Vegas has become. And I think Utah is being a little bit underestimated. And then, of course, I spent a lot of time with the New Jersey Devils down in New Jersey. And I think they're another team that's being a little bit underestimated. They added some good pieces to their back end. Their top six forward group looks really good. If they're healthy, they're going to be a serious, serious contender to be one of the best teams in the Metro, I think.
What did you make of the way the Leafs handled the transition from John Tavares to Auston Matthews as a new captain? Do you think it matters at all, or is it just kind of shuffling the deck chairs? What did you make of the whole situation?
I think that there's been a clear message around the Toronto Maple Leafs that they're trying to change the vibes of that team. I think they want to usher in a new era. They have the pieces. They're a phenomenal regular season team. And in the postseason, they got over that first round hump. They're just not able to make it to the finish line. And I really don't think there's a ton of on ice pieces missing. I say that lightly because their goaltender situation has been a big sore point for me over the past couple of seasons, but I'm really excited about the future of Joseph Woll. So I think they've alleviated that concern as big as it was for me. I'm still a tad bit worried, but that was my biggest on-ice concern for the squad. Off-ice, I think, is where they're making the moves. They brought in new management recently, had coaching change, and now this is kind of like the final piece of ushering in a new era. I think John Tavares handled it really well. I was at the presser where they made that announcement. He had his kids wearing Auston Matthews jerseys with a C. That was his idea. So he's definitely stepped up and showcased that he's still going to be a leader in that locker room. But this is Austin's team. It has been for a while. He has been a leader. He's been a part of that leadership group. Taking the next step, it's showing that the Leafs are kind of all in and they have one goal in mind. So I know a lot of folks may think it doesn't make a huge difference, but for all of the players in the locker room, it definitely does make a difference. And I think that they're probably going to want to buy into this new belief because they're seeing that their team is changing pretty much everything they can to usher in the new vibes to actually make it happen for them.
I don't want to potentially ruin any preseason content that you're going to unveil, but in about 30 seconds, do you have an early Stanley Cup lean?
This is tough for me because I've gone out in flames for the last 2 years and I've backed the same team for the last two seasons because I thought that they were going to make it happen. That was the Carolina Hurricanes. And this is the first time where I don't have the Carolina Hurricanes winning the Stanley Cup in the last 3 years. I do have some preseason content coming out, so I'm going to tease it, but it's not the Hurricanes. Everyone says I pick them every year to win. And I had my reasons, okay? They could have done it both of the past two seasons, but it's not the Carolina Hurricanes this year for sure. That's all I'm going to say so far.
Okay, we do have to wait for the preseason content, but we do know Anna has crossed off the Carolina Hurricanes because, like any sane person, you got to do it eventually because they keep running into the same brick wall, at least it seems. We'll do this again. We'll get the actual Stanley Cup pick from you a little later on. Thanks for jumping on with us, Anna, and have a great broadcast tomorrow.
Thanks so much. And if anyone from Carolina is listening, I still love you so much. Any Canes fans, I promise.
Not enough love to pick them again for the third straight year.
She wasn't alone.
Evidently.
Let's face it. I mean, they were a popular pick.
They have been a popular pick. Hipster pick, for sure. We got about a minute and a half. Let's do some bets for tonight. It's possible that the NL Rookie of the Year, although he's in that conversation too, is decided tonight, that being the Rookie of the Year. Paul Skene's wobbling a little bit. Jackson Merrill is hot on his heels. So I suspect that Paul Skene's going to have a good outing, a bounce back outing, get himself two hands back on that Rookie of the Year award. Pirates minus 125 against the Mariners tonight. And this weekend, I like the Browns minus 3 in preseason action.
Preseason football.
Just look at the depth chart. Browns have a good
preseason.
Browns
football.
Have a good quarterback depth chart. I'm riding the Browns the whole preseason.
I love it.
Doesn't matter the opponent.
I can't go there yet. Not preseason football for me. I'm going with the Arizona Diamondbacks against the Tampa Bay Rays tonight. The Diamondbacks have won 6 in a row, 9-1 in the last 10. Very good baseball team, but the Tampa Bay Rays not so great this season, and Arizona's feeling it. So give me the D-backs. It was even money, too. It's just, I don't get that one.
I love the D-backs. I'm buying D-backs stock. I think they might go back to the World Series. You're going to get comfortable there because I'm off for the next 2 weeks. You're filling in for the entirety of those 2 weeks.
Yeah,
English, I believe.
Seems like it.
And you've got one more Paris story that you can deliver while I'm gone. It may involve a shower and carpet. I'm just going to leave it at that because we don't have enough time to tell the story.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a pleasure doing the broadcast with you, and you'll keep my seat warm.
Thanks,
for
man.
A couple weeks.
Yeah, no, it's always fun coming in here with you. And have a great trip.
Thanks, man. Appreciate the crew today. Mike Gentile, our producer, Armin and David Stiss working in the back. That was the Fan pregame on Sportsnet 1 tonight, Baltimore and Boston in progress on Sportsnet, the Yankees and Tigers. Have a good weekend, everyone, and have a good couple weeks.